I'll call the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee to order. We do have a quorum. The clerk has noted the roll. Will someone move the minutes of February 1st?
So move.
Representative.
I move the minutes of February 1st. What is that? February 1st.
Representative
Mason. A while ago.
Move the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. The minutes are approved. Today, in your folder too, Betsy Parker has an insert. There was a request last committee meeting for some MnDOT information that should be in your packet. Let's see. And today we start with an overview of the railroads, and we have Bill Gardner from MnDOT going to start the presentation. Welcome, Mr. Gardner.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoover.
If I might, could you share with us your agenda item number 3 is the subcommittee reports? And so what was your, are we going to hear those bills again today or?
Representative Holberg, we have to move those from subcommittee. There is no fiscal impact, so we'll move those. We have to move those out of this committee to the finance committee. And that's it. We will make that motion. We can do that now. We'll do it sometime in the process when you get there, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I thought this was the finance committee.
Beg your pardon?
You said you were going to move it from the subcommittee to the finance committee, but I thought this was the finance committee.
These bills started in the subcommittee, and because they don't have the financial impact on either one, that's the financial impact is in public safety because of the penalty clause. So we have, if you look, are they in the fiscal notes? We've got a fiscal note. There's no impact for this committee, except that there wants to be further discussion. We're assuming this is the procedure they told us to follow. So we're assuming because there's not a fiscal implication for this committee, it's a kind of a, have to get the subcommittee report and remove the subcommittee report to the wherever committee is supposed to go.
And then just for clarification purposes, Mr. Chair, there is a fiscal impact if this passes and there's a $15 million in federal funds that would come to the state to be used for various safety and or educational programs that would be under the jurisdiction of your committee. So how will you handle that fiscal impact?
Representative Holberg, according to our fiscal note, it isn't. I didn't see that in the fiscal note.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I think the fiscal note addressed the fine issues, but the federal government has set up a program whereby if you enact primary seat belts, you get a one-time, I believe it's $15 million federal appropriation, and that appropriation would fall under this committee's jurisdiction. And so I'm curious as to, I mean, I understand why you're going to pass this. I'm assuming at some point it'll get to Mullery's committee as well. But if this is to go into law, there's a $15 million federal appropriation that would be your committee's jurisdiction, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Well, Representative Holbert, the only thing that I can do is look at this fiscal note, and it doesn't say that, but we can lay this over and check it further. It doesn't.
Well, and Mr. Chair, it's not my intent to slow the bill down, but I'm just, yeah. I mean, certainly I would support a motion to move it on to Paymar's committee and or Mullery's committee to keep it moving, but I'm just curious as to the federal safety funds that would be under your jurisdiction, how you would handle that.
Frankly, Representative Holbert, I didn't gather that, so I wasn't aware of it. I just looked at this and I didn't even think of it. I'm not really aware, is that based on if the bill passes the legislature, basically? So it's kind of on something that could happen, but we aren't assured of that. Isn't that correct?
I'm sorry. And Mr. Chair, in past years, While it's never passed the House, it has passed the Senate and was included in Chair Murphy's omnibus bill, with the appropriation then being distributed between MnDOT and DPS for various safety improvements and education programs. And so he would carry it in his transportation bill because of the revenue from the federal government.
Wait a minute, it's got an inflation here. Representative Holbert, we'll just lay this one over till the next committee meeting. Mr. Gardner, you may proceed. Or did they have another question?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, we could probably still move Representative Johnson's
Yeah, we can move bill. Johnson's state
government.
I was going to pick that up later.
We'll get there.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but it is reflected in the fiscal note.
I see that, but it's short.
Here on
zero. Right.
It does have, it says 16.8,
right.
I guess, is a new figure. I guess it must go up every year or something. Maybe we should wait a little longer.
Maybe it'll go up. We'll just temporarily lay this aside, then, as long as we have Mr. Gardner up. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, Chair Leader, Representatives. My name is Bill Gardner. I'm with the Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations at MnDOT. What we'd like to do is to give you a quick overview of both the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program and also a little bit later on the Minnesota Port Development Assistance Program, both of which are designed to improve the infrastructure of our state's freight transportation system, to improve competitive options for our shippers, the companies that are moving the raw materials and finished products in the state. And from a parochial standpoint, both the water and rail programs help us to better manage truck traffic on our roadways so that we can reduce wear and tear on our pavements and bridges. The freight system includes a number of modes of freight transportation in the state, including trucking, rail, water, air cargo, and also intermodal freight that's moved in containers and truck trailers, transferring between modes. As the demand for freight grows, as industry standards move towards heavier trucks, towards longer trains, heavier rail cars, larger ships, the capacity and the condition of our physical infrastructure becomes increasingly critical. If you look at how weights carried freight's carried across the various modes, clearly trucking is dominant in the state, but actually we have a relatively balanced freight transportation system compared to a lot of states which don't have a strong rail and waterway system. Perhaps the biggest challenge that we're facing is really the growth in freight that we're experiencing and project to experience in the years ahead. You can see, particularly in the trucking sector, up to an 80% increase by the year 2020. Freight shipments tend to go up and down with the economy, but the long-term trend is growth, and it's actually increasing at a rate that's faster than that of passenger travel overall. We think the best way to approach this is really to maximize the capacity of each of our freight transportation modes, to try to strive for a better balance across the individual modes, to provide better connections between the modes, and also better connections to the national and international markets. Our Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program has been around for about 30 years, and it was originally introduced as a response to the rapid abandonment of rail lines, branch rail lines, by the large railroads. The program has helped to preserve many miles of rail service in Minnesota. It's helped to also nurture the growth of our smaller railroads, the regional and short line railroads. And the program represents a partnership between the state, between county-based regional rail authorities, the railroads, and the shippers of Minnesota. The program is primarily a revolving loan-type program to upgrade essential infrastructure, especially track infrastructure on rail lines. It's really the quality of the track infrastructure that determines the speed at which trains can move and the weight of the rail cars that they can carry. We make no-interest loans for rehabbing rail lines, either to public rail authorities or to private railroads, almost all of which are exclusively our smaller railroads. And these are repaid over time based upon the amount of freight that's generated on those lines. Another primary element of the program is providing loans for what we call capital improvements. These are more spot improvements as opposed to rehabbing an entire line. And these are for shippers, the users of the rail service, for things like rail spurs, to provide them access to rail service. And these loans are paid back on a fixed schedule over 10 years.
There's
a couple
Gardner.
Other components to the program.
Mr. Gardner, excuse
yes,
me just a minute. Representative Beard had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gardner, when you're talking about what we call the rail service program, the Mercy program, that's the one?
Yes.
We've got particularly the loans to railroads. We had, I believe, a revolving, what amounted to like a revolving fund, didn't we, where there was some money that the state bonded for years past that we would loan out, be repaid, and loaned again, so it worked several times over. If I remember right, the first year some of us came here, we had the overdrawn checkbook. Did we take some of that money that was sitting on account somewhere? And you can talk a little bit about that and where that balance was and so on.
Chair Leader,
because I'm going somewhere with this, Mr. Chair, whenever he's
done. Chair Leader, Representative, yes, we did. We do use a revolving loan. We also have regular appropriations to the program because the payback period for these projects extends for quite a period of time, and so mm-hmm. to initiate new projects, we do need new infusions of capital. We did have funds in the account that were withdrawn to help balance the general fund in two consecutive years, I believe, about 2003 and 2004. I think $2 million each year was taken back from the fund. We do currently have a balance of, I think, about $4 million, which we're using to solicit new projects and to initiate new projects.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You got a little ahead of me with how much is in there now. So there's about $4 million on hand now that we can work with for working particularly with the railroad companies, not the spur line or the shipper improvement program, but actually helping some of these small railroads increase the strength and durability of their track.
Chair Leader, Representative, those are funds that can be used for any aspects of the program, depending upon the applications that we get and our evaluation of those proposals. So it could be for the railroads, it could be for shippers, it could be for rail banking, for example.
Good. Thank you. That'll do for now. Thanks.
No further questions.
Correct.
I'll continue on. The other components of the program, most notably the rail bank program, does preserve abandoned rail corridors for future transportation use, and virtually all of those corridors are converted into recreation and trails. Over the history of the program, we've completed literally hundreds of projects. You can see the state funds have leveraged significant amounts of other types of funding. And we've made many upgrades and improvements. I won't go through these in detail, but you can get a sense of the percentage of the overall funding going into the different program elements and the outcomes of those investments. Most recently, funding was provided by the legislature, in some cases for some dedicated projects and in other cases for general program use. All of these projects are in different phases of development and are currently moving forward. Over the past 6 to 9 months, we did conduct a comprehensive review of the program. We haven't made many changes over the past 30 years. Certainly industries change, economic trends have changed in the state. We want to make sure we're still relevant to those needs. We talked to stakeholders, both public and private. We looked at similar programs in other states, and we decided we did need to introduce some more flexibility in the program, and so we're pursuing the changes that you see here. We would like to make railroads also eligible for capital improvement loans so they can address some of their needs, such as intermodal facilities and maintenance equipment and so forth. We want to broaden the eligibility of different types of activities for capital improvement loans. We'd also like to increase the budget cap that we have for capital improvement projects from $200,000, which frankly doesn't buy much in the way of rail infrastructure anymore, up to $500,000. And finally, we'd like to streamline the application process for both capital improvement loans and for the larger rehab projects. I wanted to just quickly wrap this up by touching on safety. Rail safety is an important component of our overall program. It's not part of the rail service improvement program per se, but our office devotes a lot of resources towards it. You can see we've made tremendous progress over the years in reducing the number of highway rail grade crossing crashes. Back in the 70s, we had about 30 such crashes per month. Now we have about 5 per month. We have over 4,000, about 4,400 public grade crossings in the state. We've installed flashers or flashers and gates at about 1,300 of those crossings, and we use primarily federal rail safety funds to introduce improvements at an additional 30 locations per year on average. While we've made progress on the vehicle train crashes, we still have a real problem with pedestrian crashes, which are much tougher to solve. You can see we went from 2 fatalities of pedestrians in 2005 up to 10 fatalities last year. Frankly, we have too many people walking along rail lines, crossing by foot on rail lines with sometimes catastrophic results.
Excuse me, sir. Representative Holberg, could you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to your number of rail crossing, the fatalities, it really doesn't have much meaning without the context of how many trains or the frequency of trains. So are there a lot fewer trains in 05 than there were in 1970? Or
Chair Leader, Representative, overall there's many fewer miles of track, but actually there's many more miles of train travel that are using a smaller rail network. So this is actually in the face of quite significant increases in both train traffic, increases in many cases on the roadways of vehicle traffic, and also population growth and so forth. So it's I think it's a very successful story.
So do you have less crossings then than you did in the 70s?
Mr. Gardner?
Chair Leader, Representative, we are actively trying to reduce the number of crossings because, of course, that's the best solution for safety, is not to have a crossing at all or to have a grade separation. I don't know the actual number of crossings and how that's changed over the years, but I can certainly get you that information.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Gardner, there's still participation by the state as far as signalized. Like they used to be, or is there a match to establish a signal at a crossing or cross arm gates or anything?
Chair Leader, there's generally a 10% match on that federal money.
It's a federal money with a local or state match, in other words.
That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
With that, I'll. Yes.
I'm sorry.
She got me. Representative Horkman, I was thinking of.
Representative Horkman. We've got the row of H's over here. Hornstein, Hausman, Horkman. Mr. Chair and Mr. Gardner, I'm sorry if I interrupted you as you were just about to say, with that you take questions. But you had a statistic on there, the slide after that one, before Representative Holberg asked a question. The pedestrian fatals in 2006. I think a few of those were suicides, is that right? And I know at least one or maybe two of them were in my legislative district. I was just wondering if that was a newer phenomenon that you're seeing on those pedestrian fatalities.
Chair Leader, Representative, yes, several of those were suicides. That is an increasing trend. It's a increasing national trend, and there have been some national initiatives to try to address suicide prevention, especially at rail crossings. As you can imagine, it's a difficult thing to control. There's a significant education and outreach program nationally that has local chapters called Operation Lifesaver that to some extent addresses suicides. But yes, it's an increasing problem.
Thank you.
Any further questions? For Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Over Highway 100 in the western suburbs is a twin railroad bridge that is involved in the future redevelopment of that stretch of road. Now, how does the railroad participate in helping to pay for that? You pay any of it, or MnDOT pays all of it if they're going to redo the road, or how do you work that out?
Mr. Gardner?
Chair, leader, representative, it's my understanding that it depends who owns the bridge, and in some cases it's the railroad, in some cases it's the road authority, and I think the shares are apportioned accordingly. In that particular instance, I'm not familiar with the details. I can try to find that information and provide it to you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Salmas might have some additional
information. There's no general, Mr. Chairman, there's no general rail on it. Your tracks are on it, or the railroad tracks are on it, and it has to be torn down for road improvements. There's no rule of thumb or whatever.
Mr. Chair, my name is Cecil Salmas. I'm the director of the Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations for MnDOT.
Yes.
Mr. Arad, I believe the bridge that you're talking about is right at Highway 7 over Trunk Highway 100. Generally, whoever initiates the rebuilding of the bridge becomes primarily responsible for the cost of the bridge. So as we look at widening Highway 100, that bridge is still considered functional. Our bridge engineer does go out and inspect railroad bridges as well as all other bridges. As long as that bridge is considered safe for operation, the railroad would say we have no need to replace it. It becomes then the responsibility of the road authority to take on the rebuilding of the bridge.
Any further questions? No. Thank you, Mr. Selnick. He was, for the members of the committee, he's not a railroad man now, he's something else, but he used to be a railroad man. Mr. Gardner?
Chair Leader, this was actually the end of my presentation. We can either entertain more questions or move on to hear from the railroads.
I have a question. What extent of the abandonments, are you still having some abandoned railroads? I think we've not that many, but I think there's one or two, aren't there, or not?
Chair Leader, there are a couple of processes that might be working towards abandonment, but it's much less of that activity than there certainly used to be.
Any further questions? Not. Thank you very much, Mr. Gardner. We let you off pretty easy, I guess. The Mr. Apitz.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Apitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and we represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association here. And just for the record, I want the committee to know that Cecil Selma still is a railroad person for our measure. We think of him dearly. Not that he could possibly be superseded by the guy right next to me, as you see right here. Again, I'm John Apitz, and with me is Brian Sweeney, who will introduce himself. He's with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, better known as the BNSF. There's a couple other people here that I just want to point out in the audience. Kevin Susi is with Canadian National, up there in the back. Dan Rickel is here with Northern Lines, one of our short line railroads. There he is. Patrick Murray, who works at Messerly and Kramer with me, is with us as well and does tons of work for our association. And I think Phil Qualley is up in the back. Phil Qualley is with the UTU, United Transportation Union. So you get a little sense of the ball field here, the players that are on the ball field. We're going to take about 15 minutes, Mr. Chairman, and thank you very much, both to you and to your staff, to talk about railroads, freight railroads in particular, here in the state of Minnesota. You have some materials right here that might be useful for reference. I know you don't get enough material to go through, so we thought we'd throw a little bit more in. But some of the items that may be of interest are a railroad map that MnDOT put together. I think Committee Administrator put these materials in a little bit earlier. You can look at it this way. You can look at it in a colorful fashion. These are some of the railroads and the speeds at which they travel around the state. Here's a metro railroad map when you're trying to find your way around the metro area and what might be there. And if you're from the rural areas, you might take a look at which railroads, some of the facilities that load grain, load ethanol, load other sorts of farm commodities are located on. I think it's a rather fascinating look at what it is that the railroads in the state of Minnesota do. We also threw in the HIT CD for each of your consumption. The HIT CD known as Information About Minnesota Railroads. You're all going to run home and want to play this tonight. But this tells you a little something about every railroad in the state of Minnesota. It tells you who to get in touch with if you've got an issue vis-a-vis the railroad in Minnesota. Give you some background, give you a state map to show you where they run. And you can keep this in your desk and use it when you can't go to sleep. And so if that's not enough, you can reference our website, which is called Minnesota Railroads, and we got a lot of information about Minnesota Railroads on there as well. That's put up by our association. But I just wanted you to know that there's some materials there, and when that's not enough, Brian's here, I'm here, Patrick's here. We're happy to be at your avail to talk about Minnesota Railroads because it is a fairly exciting adventure for us. I also want to just thank Bill for discussing the Mercy program. Can you imagine lobbying for anything called Mercy? It's just great. And I want to thank Representative Holbert for the work we did last year, along with you, Mr. Chairman, and others on the committee on that Mercy program. Obviously, we spent the summer and fall trying to upgrade and bring forward some other proposals. As was indicated, and I hope we'll see that legislation in the fairly near future. So then, a bit of an overview. I'm going to take about half of it, Mr. Chairman, and ask Mr. Sweeney to take over the other half of the presentation in a discussion of our railroads here in Minnesota.
Before you start,
yes, sir.
Representative Vador,
yep.
You had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I'm looking at this map, and only because I like color. And I like understanding what I'm looking at here. This is supposed to have speeds on it. We don't have a speed key. So I just was wondering which one of these colors here represented the fastest
speed. Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow, the problem with this map is that it does have the speeds on it. They're just so small you can't see them.
Oh.
and I wish the key was a little... If you put on those spectacles, you can see that the yellow lines run at about 10 miles an hour. The blue lines run at about up to 30 miles an hour. The green ones, I can't read that. And the red ones are Brian's, and he goes up to 50, 60 miles.
All right, that's okay. All I want to know. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Minnesota's the railroads in Minnesota connect our state to the nation. And if that was hard to read, then take a look at this picture. This is the country, and this is the rail system in the country. It connects Minnesota, right in the center of all this, to the world on both coasts and throughout North America. We run down into Mexico, run up into Canada. Obviously, Minnesota is connected through the rail lines to the world. This is another color map, representative of Minnesota. We spread it out a little bit. I don't know why we did that, but we want to make Minnesota a little more, I guess, not quite so tall. There are the railroads in Minnesota, as you saw, connect throughout the nation and through the nation to the world. Interestingly enough, if you go down to CN here, you can run all the way to all the way to China. Interestingly enough, on railroad ships and into China, just using one particular line. There are four Class 1 railroads. We're going to do just a little Railroads 101 here. There are four Class 1 railroads that connect Minnesota to the national system. They include the Canadian Pacific, the old Soo Line, the CN, Canadian National, used to be the Canadian National, it's now the CN, Brian's Railroad, the BNSF, Burlington Northern Santa Fe, and the Union Pacific. And they each have different amounts of track here in the state of Minnesota. You'll note that there are sort of veins that connect into those Class 1 railroads, those big national railroads. And those are the small railroads, the short lines, and the regionals. A short line typically runs between a couple of cities and typically runs within the state of Minnesota. A regional railroad will run in a larger area, perhaps between a couple of states or over a regional area. In Minnesota, for instance, the Northern Rail runs a 23-mile section. If you go into this little part, Northern Rail's railroad runs 23 miles up off of the Burlington Northern into St. Cloud and services some businesses up there. The Twin Cities and Western Railroad, you'll note, runs 146 miles basically from Montevideo into, or the South Dakota border, into Glencoe, runs through Norwood Young America and runs into the Twin Cities, eventually over into the Port of Savage. You'll hear about these ports a little while later. The short lines, the class threes, if you will, the short lines are basically service lines servicing manufacturing areas. Then you get the class twos or the regionals. Again, the Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad hauls a good deal of coal, or wants to haul even more coal, if you will, out of the Wyoming, the Powder River Basin into Minnesota and out to markets in the east. Iowa, Chicago, and Eastern is also associated with the DM&E. And the class ones you heard about. This is a little list that you've got, I think, in the materials that are at hand, certainly on the website if you want to take a look at it. Sorry, this isn't a little bit better, but you ought to know what the railroads haul. Railroads haul a variety of stuff over the 5,000 miles, or 4,500 miles of track that we've got laid down. We haul about 3 million carloads of freight in Minnesota, which is roughly between 35 and 40% of all the freight that's traveled in Minnesota, totaling about 210 million tons of freight every year. We've got about the 13th largest number of employees in the entire nation at about 5,000. A lot of good railroad retirees here, and we pay wages of about $230 million a year and property taxes of about $20 million a year. You can see that metallic ores are the biggest commodity that we haul out of Minnesota. About half of what's hauled out of Minnesota are metallic ores, and that's a lot of that's iron ores. There's farm products. All variety of farm products move out of here, food products, non-metallics, chemicals, other sort of stuff. Into Minnesota comes coal. We stay warm in this building because we have coal that's coming in from various parts of the country. We stay warm in our homes because coal runs a lot of the power plants that heat our homes. Other sorts of things that are hauled are metallic ores, chemicals, farm products, glass and stone. You're down in the New Ulm area. You know, we haul a lot of quartzite out of the state of Minnesota into other areas and other types of stone into the state. Fertilizer is a big commodity that we haul in here as well. That also, that's a quick overview. I wanted Brian to tell you a little bit, however, about railroads in particular. Drill down a little bit into railroads. And one of the things you ought to know is that railroads run cleaner than any other mode on land in Minnesota. Can you introduce yourself?
Thank you. I'm Brian Swinney, Legislative Counsel for BNSF Railway in St. Paul. Thank you very much. I think this is the first time in more than 20 years of government affairs work that I've been in front of a committee not asking you to either do something or not do something, but instead to just talk about railroads, and I appreciate the opportunity. As John mentioned, railroads are the environmentally friendly form of ground transportation, 3 to 4 times more efficient as trucks in the amount of fuel consumed to haul a ton of freight 1 mile. Fuel efficiency has improved dramatically. This is quite important to us. This is perhaps our second largest cost. My company alone consumes about 1.5 billion gallons of diesel fuel a year. Union Pacific consumes a similar amount. So fuel efficiency obviously is very, very important to us, more so in the last few years. Among the challenges that the rail industry has is the amount of capital it takes to keep it going. When you look at how much we have to spend compared to our revenues, this is the top industry. Close to 20% of our revenues, the equivalent of that, gets spent on capital each year. And in my company's case alone, $2.75 billion of capital spending for the year 2007. Typically, we spend about $60 million a year just in the state of Minnesota on track, replacing the rail, replacing ties, that type of thing. And this is just capital replacement money. About $2 billion of it is capital replacement system-wide. On top of what we spend on capitalized maintenance, there's the routine maintenance. Minnesota costs us about $11,000 per year per mile of track and structures and everything when you figure out the whole thing. $11,000 to maintain plus what we spend in our capitalized program. We're spending about $750 million this year just on expansion capital. But when you compare us with other industries, this is a big challenge. Mr. Gardner spoke earlier about the increase in freight that's coming down the line. We're looking at a very large, significant increase in demand. Coming up with the capital necessary to be able to accommodate that is one of the biggest challenges that the industry faces. What's been happening with rail rates over the past 25 years, as you can see, both in constant dollars and adjusted for inflation, or current dollars and constant dollars, rail rates have gone down, and they've gone down quite a bit. But what's happened is there's been a tremendous increase in productivity over that same period of time. That's been passed on largely to the customers in terms of rate reductions. Here's the performance of the industry since 1964. The Staggers Act is noted in this slide. That was the act that partially deregulated the rail industry, went into effect in 1981. As you can see, productivity is way up, volume is up, revenues have been trending down, price has gone down significantly. It started to trend up a little bit in the last year or two. Safety. The rail industry has placed a great emphasis on safety. This chart shows the frequency of train accidents and employee injuries. And as you can see, in both cases, there has been a significant improvement over the years. Compared to other industries, at one time the railroad industry was a very hazardous place to work, no question about it, compared with other industries. There's been a reversal, though, over the years. There's been a lot of emphasis on safety, both in training and in spending on equipment and facilities, and there has been an improvement. And compared to a lot of other industries, the rail industry is comparatively safe. Grade crossings were mentioned earlier. This is a problem. This is our most difficult to control area of safety. At public grade crossings, we lose a lot of control. These are nationwide figures, but as you can see, there has been improvement that was mentioned earlier. In answering one of the questions that was raised, there has been a sharp increase in the volume of train traffic as well as vehicular traffic. So the reduction that you saw in accidents and fatalities in Minnesota is really the result of a lot of hard work and the spending of money on improving grade crossing signals. Fatalities in the rail industry, as you can see, every year there are about, this would be a typical year, I think, but about 25 employee fatalities. There are still dangers in working around railroads, no question about that. But the largest problems that we have are with the public. Grade crossing accidents, 364 fatalities, but trespassers, not grade crossing accidents, people in rail yards, walking on track, using bridges for fishing, hopping trains and so on, 400 to 500 fatalities a year nationwide. That's really, the rail industry's legislative program for the last several years has been centered around safety efforts, but one of them is trying to fix Minnesota's trespass law, which is, I think, rather unique in that It's a violation of the law if an animal under your control comes onto the property. So if you're on the property, you're technically not automatically a trespasser on railroad property. But if you've got your dog with you, then you're in violation. For years, we have tried, and we will be trying again to fix that. This was supposedly done inadvertently, but we've had a heck of a time trying to get it fixed. We keep hearing that we would arrest all the children who put a penny on the track. There are a lot of one-armed children. In fact, one of our people, I was talking to one of our special agents, one of our security people, who said that he once caught a father and child in Minnesota who were on the track looking for the penny that had been run over by the train. unaware that another train was coming up behind them. We need to be able to keep people off the tracks, and we will be trying again to see if we can do something about trespass in Minnesota. Those are kind of the highlights. I wish we had a lot more time. There's a lot more that we would like to tell you, and as John said, any questions, any information that you want, if there isn't time today, please do not hesitate to contact us.
Mr. Chairman, just in wrapping up, just again, we have a website here, Minnesota Railroads. If you want to hop into it, there's a bunch of information there. And you can find anybody you need to get in touch with on a railroad, one fashion or another, either through here, through us. We'll be at your desk. There's sort of a renaissance, I think, in railroads. Mike Beard can tell you Representative Beard can tell you stories of the old days and I think the new days of railroading. Those are good stories to take account of. There are issues that arise with the renaissance that's taking place, both in freight and in passenger rail. We've been around since basically the birth of this nation, and hopefully we'll be around for a long, long time hereafter, kind of servicing both the freight and the passenger needs of people all over this country. It's a privilege to be in front of you, Mr. Chairman.
We have some questions. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Appitz, and then I have a question for Mr. Sweeney, but I can wait until other people have asked one question before I ask my second. And my question for Mr. Appitz is, I'm looking at this agricultural facilities and rail system in Minnesota map, or even if I look at the really colorful one, and when I look in the rush line corridor area, I see there's a gap. I understand that there were 40 miles of rail in there and that they're not there anymore, and I was just wondering who owned that rail and when was it taken out and why was it taken out?
We're all looking around.
Can someone answer that?
I'm assuming that was owned by former Burlington Northern, now BNSF Railway. Line that was taken out because there was a lot of duplication of traffic. There wasn't enough traffic or duplication of capacity. There wasn't enough traffic to keep that going to justify the expense. And as the chairman noted earlier with the question about abandonments, back about 20, 25 years ago, there was a large wave of abandonments as the excess capacity in the rail system that had been built up 100 years ago and had been sitting there with change in federal regulation, the railroads were finally able to get out of a lot of those facilities that had been losing money. So long way of saying it was probably us and it was abandoned because it wasn't making any money. Before a line could be abandoned, the railroad has to go to, at that time, the Interstate Commerce Commission, now the Surface Transportation Board, and document that there is a loss of money by continuing to operate the line.
Further questions? Representative Hortman.
Sure. My question for Mr. Sweeney was, do you run commuter rail lines in any other part of the country?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, we do. In Chicago, Seattle, we operate the commuter operations, and in Los Angeles, we have an arrangement whereby they operate on our facilities.
Are you using any ultra-low sulfur diesel in any of your locomotives or biodiesel?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. When it comes to the low sulfur for locomotives, I'll double check on this, but my understanding was that there were standards put together for the highway industry and that they were working on separate standards for the rail industry. Exactly what those are, what the status of them is, I don't know. Regarding biodiesel, no, we do not use that. The leading manufacturer of locomotives, General Electric, has notified the industry that there will be warranty problems if biodiesel is used. The diesel engines in locomotives differ from those used in trucks and other industries. It's a different RPM, greater generation of NOx and other problems that we would have using biodiesel. We're interested in it. As I noted, when you consume as much fuel as we do, we're very interested in options, and we're engaged in doing some research into making it work, but at this time, no, we're not.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, and I can just add on to that.
And we have four more questioners, and I think you're kind of getting a little crowded, Mr. Apitz, but fine.
We're going to help. There is a couple of diesels that are running out on the Minnesota Prairie Line, which out toward Redwood Falls, that use biodiesel produced at Thumpa out there, which is the Farmers Union
Marketing Exchange. It's a different kind of engine. That's the difference.
Representative Beer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to make that point, but I think they started at 2%, and we're going to go to 5 if it worked, but we'll hear more about that later. Question about loading in and out. I noticed the ethanol facilities, probably for Mr. Appitz, Mr. Chair. As we know, ethanol can only be run, I believe, by tanker, mostly by railroads. Has that been a net gain for revenue miles, for particularly the short lines and the regionals, which, you know, I'm very fond of? The corn that would have gone out on export being consumed there, are we losing the corn export and picking up ethanol? Is it a more valuable product? Is it a net win in the end, or what are you thinking about that? What are you seeing so far?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Beard, the equation is a little bit complicated. It takes about, I think it's 3 carloads of corn to produce a tank of ethanol. I think that's about the ratio. I think that's about it. And so typically you'd be losing 2 of 3 cars that you would otherwise be hauling. But the capacity situation on the rails today is such that there is much more freight that's moving on them. And so you've got a situation where we're kind of at capacity with the amount that we're moving. There's about 106,000 carloads of ethanol moving today. The anticipation is over the next couple of years we'll be at about 140,000 carloads. Each car carries 30,000 gallons of ethanol. And so you're going to see an increase in the use of that. We'll be hauling corn, probably. He'd be hauling corn out to the Pacific Northwest and some to the east. We'd be running it down the Mississippi River out of the Port of Savage. But that's been converted, and we've had to convert what we haul as well in the process. Not sure that goes particularly to your answer. We'd be hauling a lot more corn than ethanol, but we're hauling plenty of ethanol right now.
That's a good start. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there anything besides diesel or biodiesel that runs these trains now? Does anybody start using coal or anything else?
Mr. Sweeney,
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are some, a handful that we have on BNSF natural gas-powered locomotives that we're using in the Los Angeles Basin right now. But there aren't, in the United States, I don't believe that outside of, you know, an excursion train or a railroad museum that there is anything that uses coal.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
is there anything that you're looking ahead at when the biodiesels and diesel fuels run out of here, like we're trying to do with motor vehicles that we drive? Is there any, what's the future of fuels for the railroads?
Mr. Sweeney?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I could check and see what various fuels we're looking at. I know that we are looking at trying to see if biodiesel can be made more practical for use in locomotives. We have done research and have a few natural gas, but beyond that, in terms of other fuels, I'd have to check on that and see what else is happening in the industry.
Mr. Chairman, what type of tax do you pay on your fuels? State or... only federal or?
Mr. Sweeney.
Chair, Representative, it varies with the state. There will be sales and use taxes or a special fuels tax that we pay in different states. In Minnesota, it's a sales and use tax.
Thank you.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question follows up on Representative Beard's concerning biofuels, renewable energies, and projections of railroad needs, railroad capacity, as we ramp up on biofuel production. How are the railroads situated in terms of capacity, line maintenance, and the like when it comes to biofuels?
Mr. Chair, Representative, with biofuels, the track capacity will vary depending on the location. Some parts of our system, we're operating over capacity now. Other places, we do have some room. In terms of various specific locations, that will vary. Where there is a capacity bottleneck, perhaps, is going to be with equipment. As was mentioned, the tank cars that are needed for this. Tank cars are owned, except for the ones that we use for our own purposes, like hauling diesel fuel around. Railroads do not own the tank cars. The customers or a leasing company will own that. So it will be the time that it takes to get the cars online. Then there will be the locomotive demand. Locomotives takes a while to get those. They cost close to $2 million a piece to get a locomotive. Right now, we're running, it's called the Ethanol Express, trains of nothing but tank cars of ethanol going to California. Mm-hmm. We run about three of those a week, I think, out of the Midwest, about 85 or 90 cars. So it's a matter of how fast can you turn the equipment around, what type of productivity can you get out of it. But as there's more and more demand for ethanol, more of it being shipped around, that's going to be a part of the big part of the equation is the equipment availability.
If I can just augment that very quickly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow. One regional railroad in particular, the DM&E, has at the current time either under construction, or proposed 12 ethanol plants that typically range about 110 million gallons each on its line that runs South Dakota, Minnesota. One of the reasons to upgrade that is coal, obviously, but the other reason to upgrade that is to move those agricultural products more quickly. The faster you can move on a railroad track, the faster you can turn the cars that Brian was talking about. And that's why you want to upgrade the facilities and the infrastructure so you can keep that commerce going and you don't get bogged down.
Thank you. Representative Kalin, this is our last question. We have to get these people out here. We got some others.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up on Representative Fortman's question about the rush line corridor and the, I guess it's a larger question about abandonment maybe vis-a-vis the rush line. But my understanding, having biked and walked along the Sunrise Prairie Trail in Chisago County that is on that rail bed, that the rail bed and the foundation is still solid. And my other question is about the right-of-way. My understanding is that we're talking somewhere in the neighborhoods of 100 feet of right-of-way width and that corridor. And so if you could just quickly address sort of who maintains the right-of-way currently, who holds right-of-way, and then also, you know, are the foundations strong enough and the bed consistent enough so that we can...
I'll have to defer to, I think Mr. Selness is the owner.
he can answer that question.
The reference was made to the rail bank program, and that's a very important state program that holds a large portion of that.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Cecil Sellis again. Boy, you're testing my memory, but that line was abandoned, as Brian said, by the Burlington Northern. It was turned over to a short line operator, and it was chosen to operate it from the north out of Duluth. And so they operated down to a mill in Rush City. The southern part was abandoned, and I believe it was acquired by the counties and developed as a trail. So the ownership is a public ownership, and I believe it is the counties that own them. Our rail bank program, which is part of our rail service improvement program, is intended to acquire these rights of ways and to maintain them for future transportation use. They are most often developed by either DNR or counties for bike trails, snowmobile trails. They make very nice trails. They're generally 100 feet wide. And so we're actively involved in that. The rush line, I believe, is county owned.
Thank you, Mr. Selness. One question, John. Is the Rail Bank Authority, are you short of funds? Or what's the situation? Is there billing for additional monies this year? Is it, you know, what's coming up?
Mr. Chair, the rail bank program shares proceeds or funding that is appropriated for the rail service improvement program. So it's part of the overall. As Mr. Gardner said, we have $4 million. We will make allocations of those dollars for various projects. I'm not aware that we have a rail bank project in active development at this point. Generally, funding for the rail service improvement program comes out of the general fund bonding, which is taken up in the odd years.
Yeah, thank you. I think it was always kind of about $5 million, as I remember, wasn't it, basically?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow, arriving by rail.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Sweeney and Mr. Apitz.
Very kind.
We'll have an overview of ports next in the agenda. And we, Mr. Lambert, I believe, is in the audience. Oh, and Lori Laudner. Yeah. We do, our committee time goes till 5:30, and we're going to make some other activities, so I don't know how long your presentation is, but if you can adjust it, that'd be fine. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for inviting us to talk about the Port Development Assistance Program. My name is Dick Lambert. I'm the Ports and Waterways representative for the Department of Transportation. If we can see the... I'm computer challenged, I apologize. The waterway system in Minnesota, we are, on the one hand, we're blessed with a waterway system on the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River. The Great Lakes connects to the Atlantic Ocean via a 2,300-mile water route that ends in Duluth, Minnesota. And the Mississippi River system ends in the Twin Cities and goes all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, and it's a distance of about 1,900 miles. So we're blessed in that we have water access out to the Atlantic Ocean and also to the Gulf of Mexico, but also, on the other hand, of the states that have water access, we are the furthest from either the Atlantic or the Gulf of Mexico, which makes our rate structure a little bit higher than the other states closer in. We are one of roughly 32 states that do have waterway access one way or another, either on the river system or on the Great Lakes system. So anyway, just to give especially some of your newer members of the committee a little idea of the waterway system. I just in the last couple of days got the freight tonnage for 2006. And on the total Great Lakes system, we have ports in Duluth Superior, two harbors, Taconite Harbor and Silver Bay. And this past year, we had about 68 million tons handled on the Great Lakes system coming to Minnesota ports. On the Mississippi River system, which includes the Twin Cities, which that includes Minneapolis, St. Paul and surroundings, and Savage, Minnesota, Red Wing, and Winona. Those are our port areas. This past year, 2006, we handled roughly 13 million tons of freight. And on the Great Lakes, that freight amounted to, these are products on your left, on the left column, products coming to Minnesota would be limestone, which is used in the taconite industry, salt for our road systems and for our water systems, cement, lumber, bulk paper, steel, heavy machinery. And from Minnesota, the primary products going out of Minnesota are taconite. Just as an aside, Minnesota supplies about 60% of the taconite used by our domestic steel mills in the east part of the country. We also, coal moves out, and that's a little misconception. We don't mine coal in Minnesota. We import it from Montana and Wyoming via the BNSF, and they rail it through Minnesota through the coal terminal in Superior, Wisconsin. Also, our ports in the Great Lakes handle grain, and those three commodities handle over 90% of the products that move out of Minnesota via the Great Lakes. On the Mississippi River, products coming in as the railroads, we have fertilizer, cement, salt, steel, and aggregates. These are all in bulk portions. They load barges. The whole barge loads with any of these products, and they're covered, and they bring the products into Minnesota. And going out of Minnesota, the primary product is grain. We also handle petroleum, coke, scrap metal, potash, and some petroleum. And there are a few miscellaneous items, but any of these items here are at least 100,000 tons a year. Part of our waterway transportation system, the beauty as far as the Minnesota resident is concerned is that the system is maintained by the federal government. We do not have to spend any money maintaining the waterway system. The U.S. Corps of Engineers mans all the locks and dams. They build all the locks and dams on the system, plus they maintain the channel both on the Great Lakes and in the Mississippi River system. They do the dredging. The Coast Guard, I don't think I've got a slide on the Coast Guard, but the Coast Guard, the United States Coast Guard, maintains the safety of waterway transportation on the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River system. One thing they do on the Great Lakes that they don't do on the Mississippi is that they do have icebreakers that open up the channels during the winter months on the Great Lakes. As far as Minnesota is concerned on the Great Lakes, our system shuts down on January 15th each year and opens up again on March 25th. So the Great Lakes is shut down as far as interstate shipping for a two-month period, a little over 2 months. On the Mississippi River, the system shuts down about Thanksgiving each year and opens up about mid-March, again because of cold weather conditions and also because the carriers felt on surveys that were done years ago that they can move the commodities in an 8.5-month season. It doesn't help. That system does not really support the just-in-time mode that a lot of the manufacturers and users of the of products are concerned. But again, the waterway system is used primarily for bulk transportation of products. A little bit about the Minnesota Port Development Assistance Program. The purpose is to maintain and improve Minnesota's River and Lake Superior public commercial ports. This is the benefit of our port development system is to benefit the commercial of the public ports. It does not benefit the private ports. That might come in the future based on your likes or dislikes. It provides grants, and it also in the law provides loans if applicable to public port authorities for the improvement of their infrastructure. And their infrastructure we're talking about is either access to the port via the waterway or the roadway or the railroads. It improves or repairs their buildings, new roofs on their buildings, improves the sprinkler systems in some of their warehouses, their docks, anything to do with the movement of freight. And it also, an example of Duluth, several years ago they replaced several of their forklifts using this program. I won't get into any more of the benefits in that regard because my compatriot Lori Lauder of the St. Paul Port Authority will talk about that in a minute. Okay. The history of the Port Development Assistance Program, it was created in 1991 by the Minnesota Legislature. It was first funded in 1996 by the legislature. And since then, between 1996 and 2006, the legislature has provided $17.5 million for port improvements through a combination primarily of general fund or bonds and also general funds. Most of the general fund dollars were when we were, well-heeled in the state and converted a lot of the bond money to general funds. And one of the things that we need general funds on occasion because we cannot use bond funding for rolling stock or for forklifts or for things that the ports would use in order to move equipment. That's apparently part of our system. To date, we've completed 22 projects, and those projects range anywhere from about a $25,000 project up to maybe $3 million. We've got five projects in process at this time. Last year, 2006, the legislature appropriated $3 million to the Port Development Fund. And at this point, we use the funds as the legislature gives us the money to fund our programs. We've got, at this point, about $38 million worth of needed improvements to the system. So you can understand, whereas the legislature gives us dollars for the program, the money is used very quickly and put into, we set up agreements with the port authorities in the different areas, and usually those projects are completed within 2 years after the money is appropriated and the project is approved. Duluth right now has projects, Winona and St. Paul. And before I I wanted to just mention one other thing, I apologize, this is not part of port development, but it is a very important issue, and many of you probably have heard about it. The Water Resources Development Act, the last one that the federal government passed was in the year 2000, and that is to benefit the waterways in the United States. It also is to benefit the environmental or the ecological betterments along the Mississippi River system and the Great Lakes and around the country. Right now, before the House Transportation Infrastructure Committee, which is chaired by Congressman Oberstar, is the word of bill, and it includes, as you see on the screen, $1.6 billion for five new locks on the lower part of the upper Mississippi River and two new locks on the Illinois River. Now, this doesn't directly affect Minnesota, but it does affect Minnesota in that our products moving either from Minnesota down to the Gulf of Mexico with these lock improvements, those products will move faster, and probably the price will either stay the same or in optimistic times it might be lower to move product down the Mississippi River. The advantages to this system also from an environmental standpoint is that they're looking in this bill about $1.4 billion to improve the ecological system on the upper Mississippi River. If we had our way, the environment would get $8.5 billion to improve the system, and the navigation system would get $2.5 billion to extend or renew some of our 600-foot locks and make them 1,200-foot to accommodate the modern tows that are running 1,200 feet long. Also in this bill is the new lock at Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. Several years ago, the Minnesota legislature passed a resolution supporting the replacement or the rebuilding of a new lock at Sault Ste. Marie to complement the Sault lock there, which has been there for 40 years. And the problem was that if something would happen to that lock on the Great Lakes, that probably 70% of the freight moving through that system would be shut down. We couldn't move it, because we have the industry has built boats to the size of that lock, and that's the largest lock on the whole entire Great Lakes system. If that went down, Minnesota would be hard pressed to get its taconite to the east. So that lock is also included, and our legislature at that time, when the bill was initially proposed, the federal government said that they will put up 65% of the cost, and the eight Great Lakes states would have to pony up the other 35%, which for Minnesota's situation amounted to $18 million. And several years ago, the Minnesota legislature, in their resolution, supported that and said that come the time when the money would have to be put up, that Minnesota legislature would consider it. Knowing that, and knowing that the lock and dam system is benefiting not just Minnesota but the whole region, Congressman Oberstar put an amendment into the bill saying that this lock would be built with 100% federal funding. And that, as far as I know, is still in the bill. So Minnesota, assuming the bill passes, will be off the hook and will not have to participate financially in the lock. And every year that lock is postponed, the cost goes up. And right now, if Minnesota had to participate, the last figure I heard, we were closer to $20 million for the lock. So that was just a little bit of a side on the improvements that the system is looking at. And currently, any new construction on the river or on the Great, well, especially on the Mississippi River system, is paid for by the federal government and the users of the system, the carriers. They each put up 50%. So we, as Minnesotans, we do not participate in that part of the improvements to the operation. The only thing that we are looking at from Minnesota's standpoint is the Port Development Assistance Program. And as I understand it right now, I think Senator Murphy in the Senate had proposed a $5 million plan or at least a bill for this legislative session to consider. Great. And at this time, I'd like to pass it on, unless you have any questions, to Lori Lauder from the St. Paul Port Authority to talk a little bit about some of the benefits that the system, that the program has done for the ports.
Thank you. We have a question, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lambert, concerning the new lock at Huron in Lake Superior, the sea lock, as I understand, is limited to 28 feet because of granite bottom there, which kind of, as I'm told, limits the capacity or the draft anyhow ships that can actually come to Duluth. The new lock, is that going to be the same depth, or are they actually going to dig it deeper so ocean-going ships can come all the way to Duluth?
Mr. Lambert.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Beard, the lock is not the confining thing. The lock is actually 30 feet deep, and it's the river, the St. Mary's River, that is that has got rock in it.
Oh.
And that's the that's the confining thing. And so there is some talk. In fact, the United States and Canada are jointly looking at what needs to be done to increase the capacity of the system. And that's, I'm sure that'll be one of the things they'll look at. But some of that rock in the system would have to be dynamited. And granted, if and when they do build this new lock, it would be good to build it deeper to anticipate. I don't know how much more it would cost to build it deeper at that location, but to anticipate the betterment of the St. Mary's River and the getting the bottom further down.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lambert. Ms. Laudner?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thanks so much for listening to our story about how the Ports Association program has benefited us. I have some prepared comments. I'm going to be speaking on behalf of the St. Paul Port Authority. I am the Director of Development for the St. Paul Port Authority. I'll be speaking also for my colleagues in the Ports Association as well. I will read my prepared statements. It'll go more quickly that way, and I think it'll only take about 4 or 5 minutes. I think you'll see throughout my comments the theme here is aging infrastructure, and it's very important for us to continue to rehabilitate these structures so that we are viable in the marketplace. Mr. Chairman, the ports of Duluth, St. Paul, Red Wing, Winona, and Minneapolis all handle bulk commodities for transshipment into and out of the state. The efficiency of this cargo shipping method throughout the Minnesota ports clearly benefits many sectors of our state's economy, and the Ports Development Assistance Program has been the means by which we have been able to maintain our aging port infrastructure. The Port Authority in St. Paul has been able to accomplish a great deal through the Ports Development Assistance Program. We've done some of the following things. We have rehabilitated warehouse roofs. We've repaired several areas of our dock walls. We've dredged barge fleeting slips. We have upgraded a barge mooring site, and we have addressed transportation access by improving some of our road access to our ports facilities. I should add that in St. Paul, we have about 26 miles along the river, and about 3 miles of those are river shipping terminal areas contained in 4 separate terminal areas scattered throughout the river area in St. Paul that you may be aware of. Let me speak a little bit about Red Wing. The Red Wing Port Authority has made essential improvements to their port infrastructure as well, specifically the relocation of cargo handling facilities as a result of the Ports Assistance Program. They were able to move their bulkhead for loading and unloading barges. They have dredged the channel to a new location. They have resurfaced the dock and storage area and upgraded their bulkhead. Red Wing also has addressed hazardous traffic situations, resulting in safer car truck travel in and out of its ports facility. By relocating the loading facility to the south end of Red Wing, they eliminated many truck trips through the heart of Red Wing. The community, as a result, is far safer and much less congested thanks to this relocation project. And it happened thanks to all of you in the legislature and the Ports Development Assistance Program. The Duluth Seaway Port Authority has also made significant improvements as a result of the Port Development Assistance Program. They have rehabilitated warehouse roofs, also have fixed several of their sheet pile dock wall areas, They have upgraded several of their infrastructure areas that had been aging, and a lot of what we've experienced both in Duluth and throughout the rest of our ports has been deferred maintenance. A lot of these facilities were literally developed during the WPA, during the 30s. The Port of Winona was able to remove a sunken barge, which was disrupting movement of traffic to and from their commercial dock. They are also replacing barge mooring facilities, constructing a new mooring cell, and rehabilitating their existing commercial dock wall. Winona also received funds for a dredging project, which became part of a multimodal transportation improvement project for that community, and those funds were the Ports Development Assistance Fund. Very little of this work could have been done without state financial participation. The program provides up to 80% state financing for these projects, with the local port authority providing the 20% match. Mr. Chairman, as we look to the future, all of the ports have a backlog of projects. These will allow for more efficient operation and continued low-cost transshipment of Minnesota commodities via our waterways. The members of the Minnesota Ports Association assembled a list of needed future projects in cooperation with Dick Lambert at the Department of Transportation, and these projects so far equal a total of about $6.7 million. In closing, I want to express my appreciation and that of my colleagues to those of you who on this committee have supported the Minnesota Port facilities by providing this funding. We request that you continue this support. The efficient transshipment of cargo through Minnesota ports benefits clearly the entire state. Moving products by water is the least costly method of transporting goods in so many ways. And one of my colleagues describes the benefits this way, quote, waterborne commerce uses less energy, causes less environmental degradation, generates less waste disposal, and is responsible for fewer accidents and creates the least societal disruption. And for good measure, it's almost always cheaper, unquote. To this summary of benefits of waterborne commerce, I would add that this type of commerce prevents thousands of truckloads of commodities being moved over our highways, which would more quickly wear out our highway system, and would also only add to the air quality problems. And I should add that MnDOT has done a very compelling analysis of this dynamic. And so we certainly believe that it helps alleviate congestion on the highway system, as well as helps to improve our air quality system. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Loudner. One question, is there a bill in for port assistance or more money for the Port Development Authority?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is yes.
Do you know what the amount is, Ms. Loudner?
$5 million, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. There are no further questions. Thank you very much for your presentation. We'll revert back to the agenda items, and we had some discussion regarding the House file, whatever it is, 106, and I guess Representative Hoberg and I were both correct. This division has not ever handled the federal monies before. The Senate has, my understanding. The Senate has had it and used their thing, so basically when you're looking at it, and also I was waiting, we do have the author of the bill in case there were questions, so both the authors in the bill, I think, are present. So we can revert back to that. The first bill in consideration be House File 106, and that's Representative Hornstein has a committee report.
Yes,
subcommittee report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would just move adoption of the committee report on House File 106.
Now, we're open to discussion or anything. Basically, what we're doing is moving, if this motion were approved, this bill will go to the, out of this division to the Public Safety Division under Chairman Mulray's committee.
Right, Mr. Chair, it needs to make up another policy stop.
Yeah. Is there any discussion from the committee members? If not, Representative Hornstein moved that this bill, the subcommittee report be adopted, and we move the bill to, Public Safety Committee under Chairman Mulray? Is that it? Representative Hoberg?
Mr. Chair, and I might be wrong, but I think the bill was amended in subcommittee, but the subcommittee doesn't have the authority to amend, so don't we have to first adopt the amendments and get the bill in the shape that the subcommittee recommends and then have a second motion to move it?
Is that Representative Hornstein? Okay. You want to restate the motion?
So then I guess I would move adoption of House File 106 as amended. Now, Representative Holberg is saying that there was a specific amendment. Now, I guess I would ask counsel, is the bill in our packets the amended version of that bill?
Mr. Burris, did you have a comment?
Chair members, I do believe that the bill in your packet, which is CEH-0106-1, is the amended version. It's the committee engrossment.
So it's engrossed. So either way, the amendment
that
would be okay.
So Mr. Chair, that would be what we're moving then.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to make sure that we know what's going on. We're following the new rules and processes put forward by your caucus.
We apparently have it right because the subcommittee report was engrossed.
But hang on, Mr. Chair, members, I guess, Representative Holberg, you're saying that we ought to amend the bill here. Is that...
My understanding that a subcommittee could not amend the bill, that the bill would have to technically be amended as... you can make the amendment in your subcommittee, but this committee has to take action on the subcommittee's action relative to the structure of the bill. And then once this committee gets it officially in the way that the subcommittee recommends, if they agree, in other words, with the subcommittee recommendations, then this committee can then vote to keep
That's
it here.
That's the point we're at, Representative Holberg. Let's move this motion.
Okay. So we'll move that as amended.
Further discussion from the committee?
Chairman,
roll call has been called for this motion. The clerk will call the roll. Representative
Chairman, sorry,
roll call, I guess.
Be clear, what is it we're voting on? Passage of this bill from the report
to the public safety committee.
Okay.
Or we're adopting the motion first is what we're doing first. And then we have to move the bill to the public safety committee. Procedural motion right now.
Run a procedural motion right now.
To move to approve this subcommittee report. Then it becomes before the divisions, that's correct. Mr. Burris, I think that's right. And then we have to pass the bill. The clerk will call the roll.
Maybe Mr. Burris can clarify again for any confusion of the last one.
Mr. Chair, members, as I understand the current House rules arrangements, the vote that is being faced before the committee right now is to adopt the committee report from the subcommittee, which would include the amendments that were made in the subcommittee. And that would be the first step in moving this bill out of this division.
That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not asking for a roll call on that.
Representative Magnus withdraws his...
I'm only asking for a roll call on the bill.
He withdrew his motion for a roll call. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor of the motion to... to accept the subcommittee report. That's what it is, basically. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. The motion to pass. Now we have a motion again by Representative Hornstein.
To move House File 106, move adoption, and we refer to the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee.
And that's Representative Hornstein again. That would be as engrossed or with the amendment.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein moves that House File 106 be recommended to pass and sent to the Public Safety Committee. Holberg.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. It's getting late, and this is frustrating for all of us. With your motion, if I might ask a question of Representative Hornstein and anybody else wants to chime in, I heard your motion as being that to approve and move to. And given that this committee hasn't heard the bill, my understanding is that we are going to procedurally move this to Representative Mullery's committee and that it would come back here for final approval by this committee because of the federal funds associated with it. So now I'm in the fog again.
Well,
because
okay.
I'm prepared to move it to committee.
Sure.
But if your motion is that this committee is voting to accept this and move it,
I would say that it should be a procedural motion to move it to the committee, and then we'll have to come back to whatever committees they need to come back to. So,
okay, that would be the intent of the motion, then.
So, if I might, just for clarification, yeah. The motion would be to re-refer the bill without recommendation to the Committee on Civil
Representative Mullery's
Crime and Civil
Public Safety and Civil Justice.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that would, in fact, be the correct motion,
right,
and that
you.
Was my intention. I apologize for
the
confusion.
Motion.
Okay. Yeah.
Any further discussion? If not, this is a new procedure for the committee members in the audience sitting here. It's been a little bit frustrating to know just how we're handling the division with the subcommittee reports, and that's where we have this problem. In the event that it does come back here, and I'm not certain, Representative Volberg and I have had some discussion basically here now. Previously, this federal money has been not in this committee, but it's been handled in the Senate and in their bills and their budget, but apparently we may be having it as a part of the fiscal note. It would come back in here then. So any further discussion or comments? If not, please. Did you call for a roll call in this?
Just go ahead, Mr. Chairman. We don't call it. I hope we see it back because I do want to discuss the bill, Mr. Chairman.
If not, all in favor of the motion as Representative Hornstein presented it, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. The motion passes. So that we sent up the subcommittee. We also have House File 147 from Sheldon Johnson, and he was going to be here at 5 in case he needed to be. And basically, this bill has no fiscal impact, House File 147. That was an extension of the Mississippi Parkway Commission. It extended their time frame. They were due to expire. I believe that was it. Okay.
Mr. Chair, so I'll just simply move to re-refer that to State Government Finance.
Representative Hornstein moves at House File 147. He recommended. Well, the move, that one's a direct one.
Yeah, that's a direct one. That we would approve this one.
Yeah, that one you approve. That House File
kind of inverted.
147 be approved and sent to the Public Safety Committee.
Mr. Chair, I think the 147 goes to State Government Finance.
State Government Finance? Well,
yeah.
Excuse me. That's a different one. Okay, we'll restate the motion. House File, Representative Hornstein moves that House File 147 be recommended to pass and sent to the, referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Any questions? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary? No. No, I didn't vote no, but contrary no.
What all that bad Johnson then?
Actually, we have a meeting next Thursday. Is that the MAC? We have the MAC, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, will make a presentation next Thursday. So, no further questions. The meeting is adjourned.